I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to Red Box, the political podcast in The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week I'm joined by Oliver Cam, leader writer and columnist for The Times, Sam Coates, deputy political editor, and Catherine Philp, diplomatic correspondent. This week we're talking about war with Spain, trading with the rest of the world, and politicians who pretend things are happening when they aren't and say things aren't happening when they really are. But we begin with Catherine Philp.
Downing Street was blindsided when the EU revealed that Spain would have a veto on whether a Brexit deal would apply to Gibraltar. An opportunistic power grab by Spain backed by a cynical Brussels, or a wholly predictable development that the government should have foreseen, exposing its lack of preparation and flexibility for the negotiating task ahead?
So, Catherine, this is very exciting, presumably, for a diplomatic correspondent at The Times, when you think we've got a war on our hands. Over the weekend, we seem to be piling in to declaring war on Spain. Just explain, for people who haven't, who had better things to do at the weekend, just explain how we got from Theresa May's letter to the EU to declaring war on Spain.
Just to clarify, it wasn't the government that declared war on Spain. It was Michael Howard. Theresa May has tried to sort of walk that back a little bit. Theresa May's Article 50 letter did not contain any reference to the status of Gibraltar. There are certain different versions of why this happened. One is that DEXU, the Department for Exiting the EU, decided it wasn't needed, whereas the Foreign Office wanted it in, or that, in fact, everyone decided not to put it in because they didn't think anyone would notice or react and make Spain bring it up. In fact, obviously, there was a huge reaction when the EU returned with its guidelines on Friday and said that Spain would have a veto over whether any deal with Britain would apply to Gibraltar. At this stage, Michael Howard chose to go nuclear and compared Gibraltar to the Falklands and said that previous female prime minister had sent the Royal Navy to defend our overseas territory. If you want to take the EU seem very surprised by this.
We were just having a quiet Sunday.
If you want to take a very sober view of it, you could have predicted this would happen. You may recall, if you pay attention to such minutiae, that the Belgian region of Wallonia managed to hold up an entire EU trade deal with Canada, and that the EU may have thought, we don't want that sort of scenario happening again. If we write this in for Spain, giving them a veto over that particular application of a deal, then we won't end up with the whole deal being held up right at the end. So in a sense, it's a rather pragmatic EU move that was met by some hysteria on the British side.
Oliver, what do you think? Is this cock-up or conspiracy? What's gone wrong here?
It's a massive cock-up. I think Catherine is being characteristically gracious in her assessment of Lord Howard. Our leader today on the subject refers to John Stuart Mill's famous designation of the Conservatives as the stupidest party, and Lord Howard is bent on exemplifying that epithet. He plainly did not understand the issue. And this is characteristic of the rather gung-ho wing of the Brexiteers, that they neither foresaw the diplomatic obstacles nor understood the trade issues involved. Lord Howard patently, completely misunderstood the issue as an EU claim backing Spain's, an EU declaration backing Spain's bid for sovereignty, claim for sovereignty over Gibraltar. It was nothing like it. It was, as you would expect, the EU backing the interests of its member states in disputes with, as Britain will be in due course, a non-member. The idea that this was tantamount to a declaration of intent to invade Gibraltar is so absurd that it's tempting to laugh at Lord Howard, but he's not funny. He's done a good deal of damage to British interests by a fatuous misunderstanding of a very complex and sensitive issue.
Sam, there was a feeling amongst some on Sunday morning, at least, that actually this had played okay because it was Spain who was seen to have caused trouble in Brussels, and the Brussels line had been everything needs to go through Brussels. We can't have individual countries going off and picking off issues and court, you know. So it was Spain who'd put Gibraltar on the table. We hadn't. We'd been sort of behaving ourselves, but that sort of didn't last the day. That was the problem.
Yes, I mean, the problem is that this is enormous. It's been a sort of enormously jolly on one level. There's been a sort of great deal of heat and light, but I think there are two important questions. The first is, weren't we already always going to have, at some point in the 18 months of the negotiation, a discussion, a row, a bust-up, a falling out, a tantrum with Spain over Gibraltar? It happened to happen at the start, but it was always going to come, I think, and pretty much everybody acknowledged that. And secondly, I think the question is, despite the intemperate and probably extremely unwise words of Lord Howard on Sunday, which needlessly raised the political temperature, has it changed in any way materially the outcome of what's happening? Has it given us an insight into what's happening that we didn't have before? And, you know, Lord Howard, who wasn't sanctioned by Downing Street, is not quite a backbencher, just a member of another Conservative member of the House of Lords, to give him his full dignity and grace, does not have any bearing directly on this debate or on this negotiation. So whilst it allows people to carry out a certain kind of European negotiation dance, of which we like to write about, I'm not sure that the events of the last 4 days have materially changed the outcome of Brexit or what's going to happen. So I think that I think the issue for me is we are going to have a number of these. They're going to generate a sparky public debate, but it's unclear whether that tells us anything material about what's going on inside the negotiations or what's going to happen at the end or at the different points where it needs to come back to be ratified by Parliament, possibly not a lot.
Catherine, what's the impact, you think, on the European perception of Britain and the sort of people they're dealing with 2 days after a relatively sober, parking security, but a relatively sober letter sent from Theresa May, sort of turns into this slightly crackers 48 hours of behaviour?
It was foreseen. I spoke to European diplomats based in London immediately after the letter was issued, and they mostly said that there was some disquiet over the linkage of security with a treaty or security cooperation, and they called that unsubtle, but they saw it as a negotiating tactic. What most people predicted was, well, this is less belligerent than Theresa May has been in the past in her Lancaster House speech. The problem is, can she bring back from Brussels something that, will not cause hysteria amongst the hardliners here, the hardline pro-Brexit lobby? And that is who the Europeans are most concerned about, their ability to cause a row, as Lord Howard has just done, over something, and to shift the blame onto the EU. So if she can't, if every time there is a stumble, it is turned around or look at Brussels, look what they're doing to us. You turn public opinion against, in fact, something that might be better for Britain too.
But if you, I mean, just looking at this issue dispassionately, take Michael Howard aside, what struck me was how quite a lot of the hardline Brexiteers didn't really jump on this bandwagon. You have more or less up to 60 people who could put enormous pressure on Theresa May within her parliamentary party in the Commons. You had barely a handful piling in on this occasion. You could actually make the case that, Lord Howard aside, what we saw over the last few days was an example of restraint rather than gung-ho bullying from those on the right, and actually put this in a slightly different narrative. There weren't great hordes of Brexiteers, as we saw, for instance, during the National Insurance row, as we saw during the EU referendum, where 30, 40, 50 Tory MPs are piling in to effect change on the government. That just didn't happen. So, yes, Michael Howard was cheeky, but I don't think he changed a lot.
Sam wants to talk this down. I'd prefer to talk it up. Yes, Lord Howard.
You want more.
Lord Howard is an essentially trivial figure, but try to explain this to our European partners.
He is a former
leader of the Conservative Party, and his the surprising thing is not that there were few people backing him, but that this former senior politician made a preposterous remark as a contribution
several,
to public
sort of exclusive to all outlets.
Preposterous, which is why he wasn't elected by the British people to be Prime Minister in 2005.
But my point
is not to play up or play down. It is simply, I don't think we learned anything that we didn't know about him, about Brexit. And also, to be fair, I'm looking for when this catches fire. This did not catch fire, and the material outcome of Brexit didn't change. So we are in danger of overinterpreting, in my view.
The person who enjoyed the most the spectacle of one NATO member threatening another was probably Vladimir Putin. So it was probably outside of Europe.
He's gripped by Michael Howard's every utterance, I imagine. Before we move on, I just want to check. I assume we're all very excited about getting blue passports. This is the most terrific news to come off the back of Brexit. Oliver, you look like a man who's thought of little else since June the 23rd.
Despite my youthful and vigorous appearance, I am old enough to remember blue and gold passports, and I much prefer the soft-backed red ones from the EU. I should be sorry to lose them.
Or as Andrew Rosendale, the Tory MP, said, it has been a source of national humiliation that you've been carrying around one of those pink things in your pocket.
Yes, well, I've got, I'm going to have my cake and eat it, because I will be, I will have my blue English British passport, and I will also have my pink Irish passport, for I am a dual national.
There we are. Are you excited, Catherine, about your blue passport?
Well, like Oliver, I can also remember the blue one. I'm just preoccupied with whether I'll have to have a Scottish one as well.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
That's a whole new conversation. But let's move on from Brexit. If there's, as well as the conversation going on with Brussels, there's a whole new conversation going on with the rest of the world, which is all about trade. Oliver Camp.
The Prime Minister's tour of the Middle East to drum up interest in potential post-Brexit trade deals is not merely futile but counterproductive. Britain's trade interests inevitably lie with big and geographically close economies, not with small and distant ones. Mrs. May should be devoting her time to ensuring the closest and deepest possible links for the UK with the European single market. There is no way that free trade agreements with other economies. Even supposing these were ready by 2019 could replicate what we are losing. It may seem undignified to plead with the EU27 for concessions, but that's nothing compared with the genuflections that the government appears intent upon with the autocracies of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Oman, without so much as mentioning their violations of human rights.
So this is particularly pertinent this week because Theresa May is on a tour of the Gulf. She's in Saudi Arabia. She said when she arrived in Saudi Arabia that just her visit alone would act as an example to Saudi Arabia of what women can achieve. Do you think that's enough to counter their not great human rights record?
I hadn't heard that comment. It is a highly imaginative speculation that's extremely unlikely to be true on the political front. My particular objection to the rhetoric of her visit is more on the economic side, the notion that by pursuing not free trade, but bilateral preferential trade agreements with anyone who will do it with us, we are somehow compensating for what we'll lose from the European single market is so absurd that I think it needs to be torn apart.
Sam, do you think they're conscious of this? Do the ministers, because it's not just Theresa May, Philip Hammond is touring the globe this week, so is Liam Fox. Do you think deep down they know that there are not big money deals to be done here? They're just it's more about sort of virtue signalling of their enthusiasm for global trade rather than the pound, shilling and some pence that they might get from it.
I think the argument that they would use, and I have some sympathy for, is that this isn't, to use a common Westminster piece of parlance at the moment, this isn't a binary choice in the way that Oliver presents it. You have two different things. You have the need to negotiate a free trade deal with the European Union, and then separate to that, you have the need to build stronger trade relations with a series of countries that are, you know, have big sovereign wealth funds and are can plough money into the UK economy from, you know, Wolverhampton through to Edinburgh through to the southeast of England. I think that everybody up to and including Philip Hammond would say that what we need to be doing is both of those things. It isn't a trade-off between the two. If you believe that we're going genuflecting, to use Oliver's word, too much, ignoring, not playing a hard enough ball with Saudi and other Gulf states on human rights in order to advance that argument, well, that is probably quite possibly true, particularly in the eyes of the public. It's a debate we've been having for the better part of 40 years, stretching back to Margaret Thatcher and Al-Yamama and the arms deals and BAE and all of that kind of thing. It is an argument as old as the hills. It's a good argument to have, but it seems to me slightly distinct from the separate argument about whether or not we get the very important trade deal that we desperately need with the European Union in order to continue trading there. I think they in Whitehall would say, let's do both, and I can't see any harm in that position.
Catherine, what actually is the impact? Because whenever a politician from Britain goes to a country with a bad human rights record, there's always a question that journalists ask, are you going to raise human rights? And they say, of course, you know, nothing is off the table. Mm. But then obviously nothing happens as a result of Theresa May saying, and of course there's the human rights issue. So what is the point of that sort of diplomatic dance?
Well,
is it actually more about the politics in our country than anything that's going on in theirs?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I mean, human rights have played a different role in foreign policy at different times for the British government. It was Robin Cook's famous ethical foreign policy. And recently, before a foreign affairs committee, Prime Minister Secretary at the Foreign Office confirmed that human rights are no longer a priority. Trade and prosperity are greater priorities. But yes, Theresa May has to say those things because actually there is an intense interest in Saudi Arabia and its human rights records in this country in particular, actually more so than in many other European countries, because we have this long-standing relationship. And people don't like the optics of the genuflection to regimes like that. The Foreign Office's position at the moment is that we exercise quiet diplomacy and we say things in quiet, you know, in private rather than out loud. I think we should be duly sceptical as to how hard those issues are currently pushed, even in private. I'm not convinced they are. And I'm not convinced that they are very much more than token in many respects. You know, there will be discrete issues such as death sentences on juveniles that may just sort of be mentioned so that it can be recorded they have been mentioned. Whether any pressure is applied, I'm quite sceptical.
Sometimes being very public in your criticisms of human rights and indeed tying it to trade has a beneficial effect. This was the case in the years of detente with the Soviet Union when the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, I forget the exact year, it was the early 70s, tied trade between the US and the Soviet Union to concessions on Jewish emigration. It was to critics, realpolitik critics like Henry Kissinger, it was a piece of grandstanding, but it actually had an effect. It had a beneficial effect. I think it's undignified for Theresa May to pursue with such amorality a trade strategy that makes no sense on economic grounds anyway.
We talked a couple of months ago on the podcast. Melanie Phillips was on, and she was concerned about our arms deals with Saudi Arabia. But actually, the conversation was about my enemy's enemy is my friend, and that actually Saudi Arabia is an ally in conflicts against whether it's ISIS, Al Qaeda, the threat from Iran, what's happening in Yemen. So it's these things. Although it's quite easy for someone to write on a placard, we shouldn't be selling arms to them, or we shouldn't be speaking to them. Global politics is more complicated than that.
Yeah, one of the interesting and difficult and challenging things about the politics around Saudi Arabia and many of the Gulf states is that there is, as with all areas of diplomatic life, a trade-off to be had. You've got trade and human rights and other areas. But the British government seems absolutely intent on not allowing us to have the discussion about what that trade-off is in public. Look, there is no doubt that there is some important and valuable intelligence information sharing coming from Saudi. We are, of course, not allowed to know what that is. But there is also the perception, in my mind, of a shift in the government's attitude towards human rights. Look at what Boris said about the possibility of Turkey bringing back the death penalty in result following the coup last year. We do seem to be less opposed to that than we might have expected to be in the past. So there is a shift. Where I depart from the government completely is the unwillingness of people in Number 10 or the Foreign Office to really want us to have that debate armed with the kind of facts of the trade-offs that they are making, just sending out the message, trust us, we know best. I'm not sure they do, and I think they should allow us a little bit more information to make that judgment for ourselves.
Well, I was going to say, we've heard some what happens when that debate bursts into the open, when Boris Johnson made his remarks actually about Saudi's sectarian meddling in the Middle East being analogous to that of Iran on the Shia side. But I agree with Sam. I mean, it's that debate is being shut down. And these trade-offs are important. And one person who's been very vocal about this in the case of Saudi and Yemen is Andrew Mitchell, who recently went to Yemen and talked about British-made bombs landing on British-sponsored schools and destroying them in Yemen, and how our trade and defence and foreign policy is working against our aid contributions there, in the most baffling way, sort of cancelling each other out. I do think Sam's right. It has to be part of the conversation.
It was a fascinating subject. I'm sure it's one we'll return to again. But now let's bring things home, Sam, and talk a bit more about domestic politics. Sam Coates.
After 12 years watching the Westminster scene, there are still things that utterly baffle me. And one of them is just how badly and timidly national politicians are at explaining things. Now, it was really brought home to me on the radio this morning. We had, it's Tuesday morning right now, and we had Damian Green here on the radio to launch the overhaul that he's doing of the Troubled Families programme. The Troubled Families programme was the flagship initiative of David Cameron to try and help families that found themselves in difficulty. The argument was that a high proportion of people from those sorts of families found themselves in difficulty later in life, so if there could be early intervention, the state could try and step in and help them at an earlier stage. Maybe that would change the their outcomes. It hasn't worked, famously. Big studies have shown that. And what Damian Green was doing on the radio was was trying to pretend that he was changing almost nothing. At the same time, a few minutes later, you had Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, introducing in a few years' time a congestion charging scheme for diesel vehicles in London. Big, bold, clear communication. Why is Sadiq Khan able to paint in big primary colours when he's doing his politics, but Damian Green and other cabinet ministers not?
The thing that immediately occurs to me is it because national politicians do big things and local or, you know, devolved politicians try to make small things sound bigger to emphasise their importance?
There is definitely the ability of national politicians to do big things, but the question is why try and underplay what you're doing rather than overplaying it? That to me still makes no sense. And I think the reason that they do it is because they feel totally hemmed in by the sort of nervousness about how any new announcement might land, fear of the media, fear of being seen to in some way breach the manifesto that they were elected on, the fear of getting too big for your boots and getting criticism from cabinet colleagues, fear of doing something too well and attracting the ire of Downing Street. You wouldn't believe how often that does actually happen. And all of that means that I think the public are quite shortchanged, that you don't have some top-flight communicators explaining what governments, successive governments, isn't particularly a Tory problem, have done in any particularly good, in any particularly clear way. Michael Fallon was on the radio earlier this week. There's going to have to be, because of the state of the British public finances, a kind of reorganisation of the way that the armed forces, particularly the special forces, operate. He went out of the way to try and minimise the suggestion that anything was going on at all. The sort of timidity to suggest change at a national level, and the contrast with that at a local level, where you've got Sadiq Khan doing that, you've got Andy Street trying to pretend that he's going to have a role in where Channel 4 is going to be braced with Karen Bradley in the West Midlands yesterday. All of these things just show that you can explain in a clearer fashion what's going on in politics, but national politicians at the moment, by and large, are trying to not do that in as far as is possible, not to upset the apple cart.
Oliver, it is this amazing phenomenon where Number 10 will let a minister make an announcement on condition they don't commit any news in doing so. You're allowed, you know, you put out your press release, but that's all you're allowed to do.
Yes, listening to Sam's contrast between a cabinet minister and a municipal politician, albeit the mayor of a great cosmopolitan capital city, it strikes me that to a certain extent, a municipal politician has more opportunity to make big, eye-catching, bold commitments. The congestion charge, in the first place, was just such a policy, something that was too controversial initially for a national government to deal with. It makes total economic sense and has improved both finances and the quality of life in London. There's also the phenomenon that some politicians on all sides get off to a poor start, aren't particularly fluent in communicating, don't know how to handle a microphone, and I don't think it's unfair of us in the media to do this, but we point it out, and there comes a sort of a feedback loop. Jeremy Corbyn is a perfect example. Everyone who knew Jeremy Corbyn before he became leader of the Labour Party knew, and I said this in columns myself, that he was not even his closest friends would say a grasp of policy detail was his most salient characteristic. He's not good at communicating with voters, and he's become worse and worse as time goes on, and it will become worse and worse. That's partly our fault, though I don't think we should apologise for it, because we're simply reporting the fact that he's not very good.
He's almost not news anymore, but it's always worth repeating.
Every time he comes unstuck again, I grow more astonished at his incompetence.
Catherine, we've got a Prime Minister who sort of made a name for herself by not committing news for almost 6 years at the Home Office. And I sort of wonder if in that parallel universe where Boris Johnson is Prime Minister, actually the licence for all ministers to be as freewheeling as perhaps he would be, we'd have a completely different style of government. That actually the ministers take their lead from who's at the top.
Well, yes, I was interested that Sam put this question in the span of his 12 years in Westminster, and I was keen to ask him whether he felt like this was a different environment to those that had come before. I mean, it does seem like we have got quite a control freak number 10 at the moment, and that has an impact on it. And I also wonder whether there's an issue of ownership, whether, you know, are ministers really sold on things that they are announcing, and do they have a sense of ownership, or are they sort of almost trying not to have the blame ricochet back on them? It's an amusing thought how freewheeling the discourse might be if Boris were in charge. I think we can only speculate about that. But yes,
I fear we might be at war with Spain.
We might well be at war with Spain.
Look, I think things have changed, and not necessarily for the better over those 12 years. Just some names to conjure with. You've got sort of David Blunkett. You've got John Reid. When I started in about 2005, these were people who made big and punchy interventions, not necessarily politically ideological. In fact, quite a lot on the Tory side would quite admire some of the things that those two individual politicians did, but they had the licence and the grit and the heavyweight approach to stuff to say, something needs to change, I'm going to do it, which is very different for today. And I would gently suggest that maybe this isn't actually what particularly voters want. Theresa May, as Matt says, is the ultimate continuity politician. She's doing Brexit, but she's almost trying to pretend that as few things as possible will change as a result of Brexit. That in itself is a political tactic that carries some pretty big dangers. But the question is whether or not that's actually where the British public are. I think one of the reasons that she herself identifies that people voted for Brexit is because they actually feel rather urgently that they want things to change. So if you've got an electorate that wants change and a prime minister saying it's all going to be the same and trying to suggest and encourage, and that's a polite term, her ministers to lean against kind of looking like they're doing big things, then I think that you then risk the danger of disappointing the same group of voters. Now, I think if you were in Whitehall, you might say, well, we're doing stuff with grammar schools, but that, of course, is just small and a pilot and incremental. You're changing some of the funding around social care, but again, that's small, incremental. We haven't really seen the results of that. You aren't seeing any great big transformation programmes. People are now too scared to do anything big. I think the voters would be quite keen if they did, because they see big problems in their everyday life. That's a disconnect. That, I just wonder whether it opens up a route for somebody Emmanuel Macron style to come in and just do it differently, because clearly there's a bit of an appetite for that in some parts of the country.
I feel like we've got a dearth of conviction politicians at the top of the country right now. And that's absolutely inbuilt, isn't it? We have a prime minister who campaigned for Remain, perhaps in a lukewarm fashion, but she did nonetheless. We have Boris Johnson, who wrote two arguments for Brexit and for Remain side by side. We've got a lot of people here and who says one thing about Saudi in public and one in private. So I think we've got a lot of people advancing policy that they don't, that they're not conviction politicians. And
let's not mention the words Justin Greening.
I wouldn't dream of it. But I imagine that the British public, Tony Blair may have put us off conviction politicians for a while. Perhaps we're ready for one again. David Cameron wasn't one, and we haven't had any for a while. So I think that people communicate when they feel passionately about something, and I think there's a lack of passion.
Oliver, there is also a real absence of big beasts. I've been reflecting on the fact it's 20 years since the 97 election. And I suspect if you ask the public now, they'd do a better job of naming Tony Blair's first cabinet than the current one. You know, you had Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, John Prescott, Jack Straw, Robin Cook. You know, the idea that people outside the Westminster bubble wouldn't even know who Justin Greening was, never mind Chris Grayling or Jeremy Hunt or...
I caution against romanticising the past. And I do this myself when I think of, let's go back to hapless Jeremy Corbyn. 41 years ago, there was a Labour Party leadership election in which the candidates included Dennis Healey, James Callaghan, Roy Jenkins, Tony Crossland, Tony Benn, Michael Foot. These were all very substantial personalities. No woman stood, of course. These are all very substantial personalities, whereas now we have Jeremy Corbyn, who's quite obviously not up to the job. Yet, let's go back to your example of the first Blair cabinet. Probably not many people in... not many voters could name more than a couple of the names you came out with. And who now remembers David Clarke, Gavin Strang? these were members of Tony Blair's first cabinet. And on the question of conviction politicians themselves, to me, the greatest political truth is the Isaiah Berlin argument for pluralism. Not every good thing is compatible. Some values are not commensurable with each other. They aren't measurable on the same scale. And I'd rather a government was aware of that perhaps tragic truth than be an ideological one, regardless of, to go back to a term that Sam used, trade-offs in another context.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. As ever, you can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox email. You can also tweet us at timesredbox and find us on Facebook. And remember, you can subscribe to the Redbox podcast via iTunes on your Android device so it gets delivered to your phone every week. But for now, from Oliver Cam, Sam Coates, Catherine Philp and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.